to give this setting, let's just take a minute to remind ourselves. Hear me all right? If we regard general semantics as a science to study the time binding, it means in practical sense it's a study of social change, progress as we call it, and the conditions which affect or which retard or accelerate it. And study of personal change, as we prefer to think of it, perhaps development, self-actualization, and again, the conditions which retard or accelerate it. We have talked about some of the problems. As we see, within this kind of a context, the basic problem is a blockage of time binding, of change, or a reversal, regression, or failure to develop one's own potential, or a failure of a society to develop its potential. We've talked about the basic problem of a human society, which we have considered in terms of the stresses which result from the uneven rates of development or change in the various aspects of the society, so that the result of this is that we continue to use information, attitudes, beliefs, and procedures, practices that were adapted to an earlier time. We continue to use them when they no longer tend to fit the new conditions. And so we produce in this way various kinds of difficulties, problems that would not otherwise exist. Now, I'd like to bring this down to a point that is of concern to us as individuals by talking about personal problems. That is, in general, we talk about the world outside our skins and the world inside our skins. The problems of the world, the problems we have to deal with come about in a rather basic sense because the rate of change inside our skins is different from that outside our skin. We change the world faster than we change to adapt to the changes in the world that we make. Now, what kind of problems do we find inside our skins, as it were? That is, I'm using this as a rather slangy phrase, not as a precise term. I suppose, strictly speaking, there are no problems that are wholly inside or that are wholly outside of one's skin. But I'm talking about the way we evaluate the problems as our own or as belonging to the world somehow. Well, a way to answer the question of what kind of problems we have that are personal is to ask ourselves why it is that people go to clinics. If you were to sit on the wall side of a desk in a clinic, what would people come to you for? What would they be saying? I think the problems can be talked about rather sensibly by breaking them down into three major kinds. There are observable impairments or deficiencies. People really do have arms gone, or they're blind or deaf. They're ill. they have cancer or some other kind of illness. They're decrepit. Or they may be malnourished or untutored, impoverished. This may be a condition of the world. Yes, it is related sometimes to environment. But the individual is impoverished. He's poor. That is the problem he has. He's understimulated or rejected or neglected. He may be disadvantaged in a world of prejudice. He may be the wrong color in the kind of a world into which he happens to be born. He may be the wrong size or shape, or a size 16, what is it, 36, 24, 36 world. He may be a shorty or a fatty or a skinny, a midget or a giant. I think that the most extensive ill treatment of man by man that I observe is that of the unconscious cruelty of people who reject other people on the basis of size or shape or color or some other kind of characteristic which is more or less built in, for which they cannot be blamed. They're born that way. And the effect of the kind of value that we place on fashion in bodily size and shape and appearance is the effect of cruelty. Persons who don't happen to be able to wear the clothes or to fit the ideal of size and shape that happens to be current, and these things do change, you know. Right now, the ideal appears to be the Russian wolfhound type of body shape, but that may change. It hasn't always been that ideal. And the Russian wolfhound type of body may go out of favor. It might even come to be that the Russian wolfhound type of body will be disfavored. So that person then would be the handicapped one, whereas today that person appears to be the favored one. This is a form of cruelty which is all the more ravaging because it's so unconscious. People do it with the feeling that in doing it, they are doing the proper thing. Everybody's doing it, so this must be right. One of the ironic forms that this takes is to be found in the problems of the beauty queens and the too handsome men. A man can be too handsome, and this can be a handicap, and a great one. Some of the problems I have seen personally from the wall side of my desk have been those of girls who were so good looking that they were rejected. They scared most boys, and they were rejected by girls because they offered unfair competition. So you have this kind of personal problem. Problems due to observable characteristics, impairments or deficiencies, or what might pass from some points of view as advantages which backfire. Now, it's obvious that although we say these problems are due to observable, tangible actualities of the person, of the body, it's obvious that they are also evaluational. Certain body sizes and shapes are evaluated as desirable, others as not desirable. There is a kind of general evaluation of appearance itself. We tend to value the package more than the contents in general. We talk about girls being attractive, and we appear to be talking almost wholly about geometry and not about anything that in some person's vocabularies would be called spiritual or have anything to do with the character or personality of the individual, but almost wholly geometry. The shape, as though the shape of a human being were somehow highly valued rather than the meaning of the person or the behavior of the person. So that these things we call handicaps, after all, reflect the values of the culture in which characteristics become problems or not. In addition, we have another kind of personal problem, the behaviorally unusual. Now, there are a number of different kinds of these. A person can have a special disability. He can exhibit a kind of behavior that amounts to a special disability. In school, for example, he may find it difficult to learn to read. He reacts to the reading task in a way that is behaviorally different from that of, well, most children. So that he does not learn to read. His reaction to the printed page is such that he's not like others. Some of the loneliest young boys I've ever known were those who found it very difficult to read. It just seems as though they found it impossible to make themselves understandable to others of their age group. If they had had a missing arm, that would have been obvious. If they had been really feeble-minded, this would have been obvious. But not to be able to read is almost utterly beyond the comprehension of the average 10-year-old or 12-year-old or 15-year-old or adult. People just don't understand why one would not be able to read. And so the children who can't and the adults who can't find it very, very difficult to get any sympathy or understanding from others for this. And so they tend to be driven toward anyone who will be friendly, and sometimes they end up with unfortunate company. The ones I've known, not all, but among those I've known have been a number who were at odds with the law. I don't mean at all to imply that anyone who finds it difficult to read is going to be delinquent. I don't mean that at all. I mean that this is one of the things that can happen when a child finds it very difficult to get the satisfactions that a child needs from the relationships with other people. He tends to gravitate toward those who will accept him. And in the case of a child who can't read, this may not be one of his usual peers. This may be another kid who's having difficulty getting anybody to accept him. And so together they go off and take part in some vandalism or something to get it out of their system. Children, adults who have what we call disorders of speech, find it difficult to do mathematics, and find it difficult even to be interested in things that are done in school. These are behaviorally different people from the norm as we usually understand it. They're delinquents and criminals, antisocial people, political and moral deviants. You find them in Pershing Square in Los Angeles, or Hyde Park in London, or down around the village in New York. They're handicapped in the sense that they're different in the way they behave, the way they think, the way they value things around them, experiences. And they are particularly handicapped if they are different in the sense that they do not recognize their difference as a handicap. Then it's almost impossible for them to be helped. You have to include among the behaviorally deviant, the champions, the gifted, the geniuses, they behave differently from most people, and some of you might very well have children when you're older who are gifted, and you are in for some special problems if you do, because they, unless they are very, very well handled, taught in the home, they are likely to find other children quite uninteresting or annoying, and a chain reaction, a vicious circle can get started, in which they are not liked, and because they are not, they react in ways which make them less liked, and so the problem can become a very great one. In general, I think one has to be sensitive to the degree to which our culture, I think any culture, tends to be anti-intellectualistic, anti-genius. We resist, to begin with, any very obvious change. We resist the thinker who is different in a very obvious way. We're uncomfortable around a person who makes us feel stupid. As one of my old teachers said, he's now the chancellor of New York University, George Stoddard, he one time said, he was making a speech before the National Society for Crippled Children and Adults about handicaps. He was talking about the handicap of being too perfect. He said if a perfect human being were to appear among us, the odds are very great that we would stone him to death. Of course, we've done this on a number of occasions. So that we simply must include among the handicapped the people who are different in ways that are highly creative, that are very good. The saint is in danger in many places in our culture. Now, in addition to those who have appearances, who have physical characteristics that can make for problems, and those who behave differently from others. We have another type of handicapped person, or he may be the same person as these others. Another type of handicap is what I'm referring to. Evaluational handicaps, the evaluationally handicapped. This, I think, is the most basic of all. And this is what I have tried to talk about in the first chapter of your textbook under the heading of the IFD disease. From idealism to frustration to demoralization. Almost everybody who comes to a clinic of the kind that I work in, roughly called psychological clinic, or speech clinics of the kind we operate here, they say about the same thing. The details are different. But what they all say is that things are not going as well as they should. They're disappointed. Disappointment is the theme. They're disappointed. Now, as you get into this, it becomes pretty obvious that whether or not that the disappointment is to some degree a function of the expectations of the individual. And this is very difficult to unravel, because in our culture we are encouraged to aim high, to want to do our best, to amount to something, etc., etc. And in a way, this is good. I think that it's good to try to realize one's potential as fully as possible. So that isn't what I'm talking about here. The healthy sort of striving to be oneself as fully as possible. This gets fouled up. Largely, I think, because of the effect of our common language. It's so difficult to talk about this without getting confused. For one thing, our language tends to be vague as we use it. And so we say we want to be successful. But successful is a very vague word. There's nothing the matter with wanting to be yourself as fully as you can. But there may be something the matter with trying to be successful when you don't know what you mean by it. There may be something the matter with trying to be popular when you don't know what you mean by it. On the other hand, it's perfectly all right to want to have friends and to be friendly. But it's the striving for popularity that can be bad, when popularity is not defined. And so, because it isn't well defined, one just keeps striving for it. No matter how many friends he has, he still feels he has to strive. He isn't popular. He's under tension to become popular, as he says. He hasn't yet become popular. Oh, he has lots of friends, but is that popularity? It's like the wealth. I see no harm in wanting to take good care of yourself and your family, economically, financially. There's nothing wrong with getting a higher salary if you can earn it, or legitimately get it, or making a profit that you can legitimately make. I see nothing at all wrong with this. It's the striving to become wealthy that can get you. And unless you define what you mean, what is wealthy? What is your goal? what is it you want? It must be defined so that you will be able to let up when you get there. Otherwise, you never let up because you never get there. You never are able to recognize when you have achieved it. Well, this is the kind of idealism that tends to lead to frustration and so to demoralization in the end. It's vague, and it's when it is defined, it tends to be a rather high aim. I don't want to take time today, but I have at times asked the girls in the class to write down a piece of paper. Go ahead and write it down anyway for your own interest. How much money do you want your husband to be earning a year after your marriage? And if you're already married, how much do you want your husband to be earning next year? Put it down. Write it down. Whenever I have done this and actually had them handed in, the results have been very clear evidence that there were going to be an awful lot of disappointed girls. The average was way above the median income of the United States. So that, you see, when you can't be sure what you mean, you tend to overstate any such goal. Because it is too valued, you see. If you're not wealthy, you're poor. If you're not popular, you're unpopular. And this is terrible. So you want to be very sure that you're wealthy and popular. And so you set your goals higher than you're likely to be able to achieve, even when you define them. One of the most interesting of these ideals is the ideal to be normal. A person wants so much to be normal. And many people are rather shy about taking personality tests because they're afraid they'll turn out not to be normal. What's normal? And you can worry about what's normal until you're abnormal. And that's the reason you're abnormal. One of the more interesting examples of this sort of thing is to be seen in what has been called Hollywood slickness, in the four-color ads, where everyone is just as happy as kings, and of course you know how happy kings are. They all have a brand new station wagon with two jugs of lemonade and a new sport jacket, and everybody's smiling. And there are people who try to live like this until they just go mad. You know, they go to movies, and these houses in the movies don't look like houses. And there are people who really go home and try to build houses that look like that, and then live in them. Well, it's very difficult. It's just hard to do, and they tend to fail. And besides, they are led to expect that if they get a house like that, with everything in place and just as slick as Hollywood can make it, that, well, of course you'd be happy there. Well, you won't be. For one thing, it's going to be too hard to make it continue to look like that. And after a while, you're going to begin to ask yourself, is this the best way to spend my life, trying to keep a living room looking like that? Isn't there something better I could be doing, maybe? These ideals get to be highly valued, partly because of this either-orishness. It's a little more complicated than that, and would take quite a thoroughgoing analysis of the language behavior of a person with this kind of a problem to reveal all of the reasons why he overvalues the ideals that he tends to be striving for. But we see some rather interesting examples of the effects of this kind of overvaluation in some of the clinical work we do, for example. One of the kinds of patients we have more and more of these days are those who have to have the larynx removed, the voice box removed, because of cancer. It's a rather successful operation as far as the cancer goes. But, of course, once the operation has been done, the person has no vocal cords, and so he has to learn to talk in a new way. And it's, in general, a way of utilizing air that is swallowed or at least got down into the esophagus a ways and then is re-emitted, sort of like a belch, and articulated. Then people can learn to talk this way quite well. And a fair proportion, half or more, of those who are well taught in clinics tend to learn to speak satisfactorily. Now, the patients who are the hardest to work with, hardest to motivate, are those who have been the best speakers. Their ideal, the kind of speech they're used to and that they want and that they value, it's so good, they can't achieve it with this belch. And so they tend to give up. We see the same thing in patients who suffer from paralytic stroke, cerebrovascular accident, and who lose their language to some degree. The ones who are the hardest to motivate to regain the language are those who have had the best speech, in general, because they're not happy with what they can achieve with the damaged brain. Whereas a person who has worked in some occupation that has not required him to speak well can be very happy with what he can achieve without a larynx or with a damaged brain in the way of speech. So a large part of the problem of such a person, if he has a problem, is not to be attributed to the damaged brain or to the missing larynx. It's to be attributed to his evaluational reactions, to the value he places upon that which he cannot achieve or has not yet achieved or might achieve. I think we ought to say a word here about conformity. We hear so much about it. It was what I was talking about when I was referring to the kinds of handicaps of persons who are not the right bodily shape or size for the culture into which they happen to be born. And so those who, under the guise of placing great value on what they call beauty, turn out to be very cruel in the way they reject persons who do not happen to fit their ideal of what they call beautiful. Well, so there is a great pressure placed upon people. It's especially felt, I think, by adolescents, both boys and girls, to conform, to look right. Now, this is so obviously an evaluational matter rather than a physical thing. I think it is good to become a little bit more conscious of it, perhaps, and many people are, in this sense. And I think it is especially interesting because there are two kinds of problem here. There's a problem of a person who strives too hard to conform to what is the norm, the fashion, the fad, the way you should look this month. But there is also the problem of the person who, in another way, tries hard to conform to the non-conformity that is current. Either one makes an issue of what can be no issue with the right kind of an evaluational system. There are people who really feel as much under a compulsion to wear clothes, let's just say, that are not in fashion, as others are under a compulsion to wear clothes that are in fashion. And as far as I can see, it's the same kind of a problem that these persons have. They're both apparently driven to conform to something. And the one is nonconformity only if you use the other as the base, as the standard. It's a relative thing. And if this becomes highly enough valued, it can become a very, very serious problem. And if not to do it right is to be a square, the value can get very high. I'm not being a square. The result of any one of these, highly valued, vaguely defined, or high, absolutely high, kinds of goals, ideals, tends to be frustration. You can't achieve what it is you want, feel you should have or do. And so people react in various ways to the frustration. Usually most people tend to fight back a while. They're irritated, annoyed, hostile, aggressive. This is generally, these are signs of gumption and health. But eventually, the fight goes out, at least to some people, and they just get sort of demoralized. And they're mainly conscious of a sense of failure, disappointment, discouragement. Things are not going the way they should. And now, if one's level of aspiration, as the psychologists technically call it, is higher than one's level of achievement, then one can react in various ways. You can keep the level of aspiration where it was and just try harder. But if it's too high to achieve, trying harder will simply wear you out. And you will fritter away what energy you are endowed with on a hopeless undertaking. But this is one way that you can react. You can lower the level of aspiration and succeed more often and become more hopeful, become encouraged. And then eventually you probably are going to raise your level again because you can. It seems like going the wrong way to get to Rome, but it seems to be the way it tends to work. If you set your goals where you can reach them, well, then you can experience success. Because success is not a word for anything in nature, it's a name for a feeling. It's a name for the feeling you have when you have achieved or exceeded your expectations. And so it's a fairly simple matter, as a matter of fact, to regulate or to control your expectations so that you can feel very successful. You can also so define your expectations so you always feel like a failure, no matter how much you succeed in the eyes of anyone else. And so you can become a millionaire who shoots himself because he wasn't able to become wealthy enough to suit him. You can raise your level of aspiration. Some people do. The more they fail, the more they dream. And, of course, this is the way to real deep sense of failure, even to madness. Another very bad result is that you can lower the level after enough failure. What you feel is failure, you can lower the level to the extent that you just don't have any aspiration anymore. No ambition, no drive. You give up, you leave the field. You may rationalize this in various ways. People do, of course, as you know. But essentially, this is one of the more profound reactions to frustration that comes from having ideals that are too high. Now, let me just hurry over one or two more words about people with problems. They may have any one or all of these kinds of problems. And they do tend to go together. And everybody who has any problem at all tends to have an evaluational problem, no matter what else you may have wrong. One of the most interesting things about such persons with such problems, is the way they talk about them. They find it difficult to say what the trouble is. They are relatively inarticulate. They may not talk much at all, or they may talk a lot and say nothing. But it's very difficult for them to be precise about it. They tend to overgeneralize and oversimplify. They tend to be too pat. They're either right or wrong. Things are either good or bad. Things are fine or lousy. They have succeeded or they have failed. It's a two-valued world they live in. There's almost no grays. People differ, but this is a tendency of persons who come to clinics. Now, what they need to do then is quite complex. I want to talk about it. And I'm going to talk more the next time about this IFD business. But I want to say enough in the 5 minutes we have left to tie all this together a bit. These three kinds of handicap or problem tend to overlap, as I've said. Now, insofar as you can abstract out one or another aspect of the maladjustment or the problem, there are things like this to be considered. For example, the person who has an objectively observable impairment, or who is disadvantaged by color or shape or size, or who is malnourished, neglected, rejected, etc. Such an individual is likely to be made more miserable, more incapacitated, more maladjusted by our persistent efforts to get him to be more like us. And this is what we so often tend to do. In the appeals for funds that are put on by societies for crippled children or for heart or any other kind of condition, the appeal seems to be largely help the crippled child to be normal. Help him to be like you are. Help the cerebral palsy to get over cerebral palsy. Well, this again is a kind of cruelty. The implication is that until he becomes like us, we reject him. He must be like us. We are constantly working on little girls who are 11 and 12 years old, and they're kind of chubby, or they're kind of skinny, or something's wrong, according to the prevailing standards of how you ought to look this month. And we're constantly fussing with them, telling them, no matter what else we say, how kindly we are about it, we're constantly telling them, every time we put a hand on them or say anything, I know you look terrible, but if we'll just work at this, maybe you can look all right. But and so we think we're being so helpful and kind, and all the time we're telling them, you just look lousy. And it's going to be awfully difficult, but I'll take time. I like you. I'll try to make you look like me if you'll just hold still. And if you try to make a crippled child feel that unless he can run, he's no good. This is not, obviously, very constructive. The point is that so far as a person has some kind of a real limitation, the solution to his problem does not lie in trying to remove that. There are persons who are always going to be deaf. There are persons who are...